The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, and Chicago. And if you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Leeds.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Tim McKenna. How was your holiday, Tim?
Fantastic. I went to a lovely, I guess we can call it a patio party, a picnic party. What did we call that?
It was a patio picnic party.
Okay,
oh, it was
good.
A three-peat party.
Yeah.
There we go. How about Ride for Miles? You getting ready for tomorrow?
Oh, of course. I've been, you know, eating as much as I should to just keep up. I'll ride, but it's all about the food, right?
It is all
about the food. It's all about miles, though.
It is. Well, it is about the memory of miles. There is still time to sign up for the ride. It starts and finishes right here on the campus of John Carroll University. And if you're interested, you can find out more at rideformiles.org. And you could join the group tomorrow morning, yes?
Yes.
Yes. We did not report on the Vuelta last week. It's a little more than halfway through. So I asked Tim to check in on the race and report back. He's going to give us his Vuelta wrap-up a bit later in the program when we do our news. I'd like to dive right into the conversation we're going to have with our one very special guest this evening.
I'm excited to hear this.
Yes, I know you are. As we begin our fifth year on the air, how about that?
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. I thought it would be appropriate to find someone a little more special than usual. Not that I don't think all of our guests are special and interesting. They all have great stories to tell. I just wanted to add a little oomph to our show tonight. So, racking my feeble little brain, as I sometimes do, I decided to get some input from Brian.
Okay.
I had a whole bunch of names in mind.
And you took this input this time, right?
Yeah, he came up with a doozy, really. And then I had to do some sleuthing, and I finally got some help from my friends, especially John Schubert. So, a big shout-out to John Schubert for getting me in touch with our guest. I am delighted to be able to welcome yet another fascinating, iconic, and revered, if not somewhat irreverent, figure in the U.S. frame-building history for your listening pleasure tonight. If you own one of his frames, you'll probably never let it go. And if you want one, good luck finding someone who might be willing to part with his. My guest this evening is Albert Eisentraut. Albert minces no words when it comes to his views on the business of bicycles, as well as the world around us. George Mount said this about his experience of an Eisentraut frame, quote, "All I want is a bike that disappears under me and it becomes a part of my riding." Albert's does that. The rest, paint, chrome, etc., is all fluff. His bikes are aesthetically pleasing, but also flawless to ride, end quote. Though he's long been retired from the art of building bikes, his memory is also long, his wit is razor sharp, and he and I are going to dive right into his history, his ideas about the U.S. bicycle frame builders world, and even talk a bit about wine and winemaking.
Excellent.
Excellent. So I am pleased and honored to welcome Albert Eisentraut to our show this evening. Albert, thanks for joining me.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, or wherever you are.
I'm in Cleveland.
Cleveland, okay. I thought you were there someplace.
Well, I am someplace because everybody has to be someplace. So I do want to give our listeners the opportunity to know more about Albert Eisentraut. Not too many people have spoken with you on air. Is that true?
I think it's the first time, actually.
Wow. I feel so privileged.
Well, they did do a movie, a documentary on the local public television station in what was it, 1969. So
wow.
I don't know if that counts.
Well, sure it counts. It's just I haven't seen it. So tell us a little bit.
I haven't seen it forever.
Tell us a little bit about your memories of growing up in Chicago. So you're from the Midwest. And about this Oscar guy, Watson. Watson.
Watson, yeah. My father was a bike racer and was a friend of Oscar's. And so growing up, all of my stories were about that he told the family and me and my sister were about cycling, cycle races. He worked as a trainer at the six-day races, and so he would be at the Chicago Coliseum, and he got waylaid to go with people to help them in other places. So he went with Reggie McNamara to Madison Square Gardens, and he was in Minneapolis, and I think he might have been to Cleveland even, working six-day races that they had there.
Yeah, we did. We had a track at what became the Masonic Auditorium, and they threw the track away.
Well, that was probably the track that he was probably working on was probably temporary, and they put it in some stadium, and I don't know where that was. I know that there was one in Cleveland in the early 50s, but this was like 20 years earlier. And so some of my father's friends were ex-six-day bike racers. So I got to meet them, and I knew them. One of them, Jerry Rodman, was a tailor on the south side of Chicago, and he made me a suit that I wish I still had. And it was a beautiful Chicago pimp suit. It had it was brown, and it had a very nice red lining, and it had cuffs on the sleeves with red underside of the cuffs.
How old were you?
Oh, when he made the suit, I was probably 19 or something like that.
Oh, so you were full grown then, so you could have actually worn that today if you had it.
Oh, I think so, because I haven't, I weigh the same that I did when I was 16.
Wow. That's pretty impressive in itself. So, okay, your dad was a bike racer. You followed him around. You raced some.
Yeah, I raced for 10 years. And I started when I was 15 and raced through the Army. I was on the Army cycling team in 1963. And then I started. I had 3 years of school in Chicago at Illinois Institute of Technology in engineering, and I went to the Army, and after the Army, I went to San Jose City College and then San Jose State, where I got ultimately got 2 degrees, a degree in ceramics, a BA, and an MA in ceramics.
Did you know John Howard from the Army team?
No, John Howard was in the Army team after I was.
Okay, I just wondered. I just remembered him being in the Army team.
Yeah, he was in the Army team, I think, 67, 68.
Got it. Do you remember Jimmy Walthour? Did you ever meet him?
Sure.
Because, you know, his kid was my his kid is not a kid. He's a man, but he was one of my reps for a long time, my bike reps.
Yeah, I didn't know his son, but he followed the footsteps of his father, because when I met Jimmy was a rep, I think it was for Raleigh. I can't be certain of that, but I'm pretty sure it was Raleigh. And I remember going to a Kenosha banquet, basically track people that were riding in Kenosha, and he was there. He was good buddies with the bike promoter of the Washington Bowl track in Kenosha and bike shop owner Don Gill. And so I spent the evening talking to Jimmy once. And so he was sort of interesting. And I would see him occasionally at bike races. And when I was in high school, I worked at Oscar Watson's bike shop as a grunt bike mechanic. And so he was in there a couple of times, too.
Hmm.
Oscar had connections with all of the old bike racers. And so he sort of knew who was where. And it partly was because during six-day races, he was the mechanic.
Did he travel or did he just stay within the Chicago area?
Oscar was a mechanic in Chicago because I know that, what's his name, Al Drysdale was a mechanic in New York.
Got it. Let's talk about your first frame jig. You built a jig back in 1959. How did you know how to do that?
Well, I was a precocious kid always, and first off, one of the things I learned early on was that one person by himself could build a bike frame. And part of that was I had been to Oscar's shop probably the first time when I was 4 years old. And so it was something in my memory. And then visually I'm good at looking at things and figuring out how they work. So I saw his jigs. I was in Schwinn probably the first time when I was 8 years old, the actual Schwinn factory on a tour from the YMCA. And then when I was 16, I would sporadically go with Oscar to Schwinn because he needed a frame, and because he had worked there before the Second World War, he sort of had a free rein there, and he would just go in and say, I want blank, 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 and they just loaded it into the back of his carry-all, and often we would stop in the frame shop, and he would talk to the builder there, Frank Recco. And so I saw stuff, and it's not particularly complicated. You had to do certain things, and I was going to IIT, I would sit in physics lectures and draw drawings of bike jigs and trying to figure out how to make it. And at the same time, I had a part-time job on Saturdays and during the summer in a machine shop. So I had access to machine tools, I had learned how to use them, and it was relatively simple to make it. I mean, it's not to make something just to hold the tubes, it's not very complicated.
I'm speaking with Albert Eisentrout. If you don't know his name, you need to go look it up because he is like the dean of American frame builders, the best of the best. So what would you say about the bicycle industry at the time you began building frames? How would you characterize the bike industry and your part, that custom building part?
Oh, yeah. Well, in terms of I did that, the first frames in 1959 and 1960, and I never thought of that as ever being a career. And the orientation for bicycle manufacturing in the United States was it was a toy. It wasn't something that people thought of as anything but a toy. There were a few dedicated people that rode. And riding around Chicago, anytime I saw anybody who was out on the road, it was somebody I knew. And you figure that there were, 5 million people living in Chicago and in the area about that time? And you know somebody on a bike, that was sort of bizarre. And so it wasn't popular. Everybody who was a bike racer had a regular job. Nobody was making any money racing. And it was all of the things that happened before World War II. The six-day races and the popularity of them had basically disappeared. There were a few attempts at resurrecting 6 days, and they didn't go over very well. I worked a six-day in Chicago. I think it was 1958 or 57. I was just a runner for a team of Peter Post, you've heard of him? And his
no,
partner,
you know what,
Harm
I haven't.
Schmidt. You haven't heard of Peter Post?
Uh-oh.
Look him up.
Is he still alive?
No, he's currently dead. And,
he's currently dead? Are we planning to resurrect him anytime soon?
Hey, you never know what can happen in Holland.
I'll look him up, I promise.
Really, I mean, he was won lots of 6 days, and he also was rode the road and was the manager of a very good pro team that rode in the Tour de France. So he was a big deal.
Okay.
One 6 day races he rode with Patrick Surcoux, I believe, and
I've always been fascinated by the whole concept of 6 day racing and track racing, and that it was an athletic endeavor, not dissimilar to, you know, watching a baseball game or a football game, and that it died. It seems to me it would be such an exciting sport today.
Well, I think I'll see. 4 or 5 years ago, I went to Ghent, and it is fantastic. And the racing is spectacular. The bike handling skills are absolutely amazing, and it would work. And there are devotees like Jack Symes would love to get it going again. And it takes a lot of money to promote it. And then the other thing it takes journalists who understand the sport and can go through and write definitively about it. At this point, sports pages in the United States are devoted to football, baseball, and begrudgingly everything else.
Right. That's true. You're
a little
absolutely
bit of hockey.
Right. Yeah.
And so, and during the height of 6 day races, there were journalists that just focused on cycling in the regular papers, and it happened in Chicago, it happened in New York. And one of the things, if you want to look up the biography of Alfred Le Turner was a French 6 day rider. He's the one that Schwinn used on some of their promotions. He did a then land speed record of 108 miles an hour behind a race car. And the book is called Le Diable Rouge, and it's written in French, but he goes through and has this little section about how the change that happened between the wars when the journalists disappeared.
That, to me, would be very interesting. I would really like to know about that. Maybe I'm going to have to brush up on my French, huh?
Yeah. So, well, it's probably hard to find the book. I loaned my copy to Peter Rich, so I don't know if I'll ever see it again.
We'll get to him later. Where'd you get your ideas about what a frame should look and ride like? Where did those ideas come from? Because people love your frames. They, like, covet them and cherish them, and they never come up for sale. We happened to get one in our shop recently. A guy was in, you know, had several accidents cycling, not on your bike, and gave up his bike. And it's like, oh, my God, we have one. It's so cool.
Oh, good. Well, too bad for him, but...
yes, it is.
Too bad he had accidents. I was just a typical bike freak, and maybe I wasn't typical for the time, but I would go through and measure everything, and I would read any scrap that I could find, so that there was a English magazine called... I think it was called Cycling, that was published during the 50s, and it had little bits of information on geometry, and there was one guy who wrote a column every month, and I would read that regularly, and I actually have a couple old copies from that I've saved all that time. And so they talked about geometry and some of the things that were important, and one of the articles was about Reg Harris, former world sprint champion, his bikes, and it talked about the changes that they made in his bikes. And one of the things I did early on, I actually built a road bike that duplicated the Reg Harris track bike geometry. And that wasn't so weird because the tracks he was riding on in England were basically flat. It's like riding at Northbrook, big 400-meter tracks with no banking. And so it's like riding the road. And it turned out, for my size and my weight, it was a really a bike that handled perfectly. And then I started thinking about, okay, how do you change it for different body sizes and different body proportions? Because I'm not exactly sure in the process where I came up with the rationale for what I was doing, but it seemed like a bike that rides well, you and the bike are in harmony. You enter the turn at exactly the same time as the bike does. And if you are riding a bike that has, for example, a too short top tube, your head is out in front of the bike, and so you go through and the sense of being vulnerable, and you're leading the bike around. And the reverse, where the top tube is too long, you've had the feeling like the bike is leading you around. But when the top tube is the right length for your torso and where your head is basically the point in your head that's important is your inner ear where you sense balance. If that's in a good position in relation to the steering axis of the bike, you feel comfortable. And so when I started designing bikes of different sizes, I went through and got a hold of a anthropomorphic chart that went through and gave the relative proportions to a body for a bunch of different sizes. And for the sizes that I didn't have, I sort of interpolated, just like you would interpolate using log tables. So that's one way I tried to get a relationship to size. Doing the inseam is sort of easy, but getting the top tube right is the thing that's important. And so it was sort of an average thing. And I used that initially on the first production bikes that I made, starting 1974 through 76. They were called Limiteds. And I built about 1,000 of those, and I stopped when I ran out of decals.
Because you could order decals in 1,000. Once again, I'm speaking with Albert Eisentrout. We are talking about frame geometry, and you are the first person. Now, I have been in the bicycle business for 40-plus years. I was a bicycle fitter since 1984. You are the first person who has used the actual comments about the top tube in a way that makes perfect sense to me, and I always look at where somebody is over the stem, over the front of the bike, to see what's wrong with fit. First, that's the first thing I look at. I'm so happy that you confirmed that that is an important thing. Very cool. That's exciting. Okay. Anyway,
then you go through and get into other things with bike geometry. One of the things that happens for this is just sort of run of the mill, how you build a range of sizes. By going through and shallowing the head angle and extending the fork rake, you make the bike more stable. And going through and steepening the head angle and shortening the rake, you make the bike less stable. When you put 100 pounds on the bike, the body has momentum, and you have 200 pounds on, and it's got, I don't know, maybe four times the momentum. And so to compensate it for that, for somebody that's light, you make the bike more stable, and for somebody that's heavy, you make the bike less stable. And so the assumption when you're going through and making a range of sizes is your 48 centimeter frame is going to be for somebody that's going to be weighing maybe around 120 pounds, and your 63, 64 centimeter frame is going to be made for somebody that's pushing 200.
So rather than the height, you're not looking so much at height, you're actually looking at the weight.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. What happens when you get a heavy, short person?
Well, then you go through and you make compromises. But that isn't what you do if you're just doing a range of stock.
Yeah,
sizes.
You're right. Of course. Of course. Custom and production are different. We need to take a real short break. I'm speaking with Albert Eisentrout. We'll be right back on The Outspoken Cyclist and continue our conversation.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. We're going to continue our conversation with Albert Eisentrout, and we were talking about frame geometry and production bikes. I want to move toward some of the more modern stuff because I'll bet you have some really interesting statements about today's bicycle business. You did make a statement that bike building is not romantic. That was way back in 1987. Now we have NABS. You know, we have this sort of resurgence of the quote-unquote hand builder. Do you think that statement is still accurate, that it is not a romantic business? Has that changed? What do you think about today's custom bicycle business?
I think a number of different things. I think the people that are actually going to the hand-built bike show, they're doing it for camaraderie with other builders, and that's my guess on it. I've never been. Don Walker wanted to pay my way, and I said no, I didn't want to do that. And one of the reasons that they should be going to any show is to sell product and not to schmooze. And so I guess it's good that they're enjoying themselves. But they're not making any money doing it, so I miss the point, personally. One of the things that's happening is they go out of their way to make bikes that are really beautiful. And I've looked at pictures of stuff, and some of the stuff is just amazing. So on one hand, it's great that the aesthetics are there, but it's too bad they're not making any money. One of the things that... Mark Norstedt, who is the owner of Paragon Machine Works, who makes a lot of parts for frame building, he makes the claim, and he knows lots of builders because he sells to most of them. The ones that are happy are the ones who are married to somebody who has a good income, and the ones who are unhappy are the ones who just have to depend on their own resources.
It's an interesting perspective, and it's not one I do not understand. I do understand it. And in fact, several of the frame builders I know and who have also been on the show have somebody behind them, you know, pushing them to do the work that they're doing. And then there's other income. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. It's too bad because it's such a wonderful business. And today you can walk into a bicycle shop and pull a $10,000 production bike off the wall. Why wouldn't you go get a custom bike instead? What do you think about that?
Well, it's part of it is the material is the message. And, yeah, there are a few people doing carbon bikes. And I guess one of my early students, Bill Holland, is doing more and more carbon bikes.
Well, what do you think about carbon? You're a you were a steel builder. And in those days, that's all there was. There is still a lot of steel being built and ridden. But when you walk into a bike shop today, all you see, it's carbon all the way down. What do you think about it?
Carbon and aluminum.
Some aluminum. You're right.
I think the part that scares me the most about it is the possibility of immediate failure, unpredictable. And every time there's a serious crash like Alberto Contador in the Tour de France this year, his bike is trashed, and they say, oh, the bike didn't fail.
Right. Oh, really?
He's playing out of four. He's out of the Tour, but the frame didn't fail, and who knows? I'm suspect, and I'm willing to bet that it was a frame failure that had something to do with his fall, but who knows?
Well, we're certainly not going to get specialized to admit to that.
No, certainly not. And understandably, but there's enough failures, and boy, a carbon fork with a carbon steer just scares me to death. And I can't imagine putting one on a bike for anybody that I liked.
Do you ever want to get back in the shop and pick up a torch, or do you? Do you ever get back in the shop?
Well, I typically make a couple of bikes every year, and I have done that for the last, 6 or 7 years.
Wow. Who are the lucky people who get those bikes?
Usually somebody whose bike was on a roof rack on their car. The roof rack is a frame builder's friend.
It really is. And what's really funny is that just happened to one of our good customers recently. He sent Brian a picture, and there it is. Top tube bent, fork bent, all but yeah, new bike time.
And so these are old customers who I feel a little sorry for them.
Sure.
And I don't really. I took down my website maybe 10 years ago, raised my prices, and changed my phone number.
So to disappear?
Well, I didn't disappear, but anybody who finds me has to really work at it.
And you know what? The truth is, I did have to work at it. I didn't have to work really, really hard, but I did have to work at it to find you to get this conversation. So I want you to tell me, I want you to redial back in your memory and find me a story or two that you would like to tell me about your days, either as a builder or as a racer or something about the industry that people don't necessarily know. I know you're funny and I know you're punny, and we can do that later. But I do want to talk about wine at some point, just what kind of wine you are making and drinking for yourself. But I would like to know a story.
I'll tell you, this story is sort of, it is funny. I was at the 6 day bike race, and I was working for a team of Pat Murphy and Brian Robinson. Brian Robinson was a English road racer, and right next to our booth at the 6 day, our cabin at the 6 day race, was an Italian team, and this young Italian was former world amateur sprint champion, and he was really handsome. And so it's the fifth night, it's sort of slow between jams, and Alfred LeTourneur, the French bike racer, who at that point was 60-something, had with him a attractive, small, high-maintenance blonde woman who was probably in her 50s, and she was enamored with this sprinter, this Italian sprinter. And so LeTourneur is having negotiations with this guy because this woman wanted to sleep with the sprinter. So they're going back and forth and back and forth. And this was 1961, so she was offering him $200. And he's just checking the sprinter saying, no, 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 never, never. And then LeTourneur explained to him how much $200 was in lira. And he accepted.
This is like during the races?
Yes. His partner was on the track, and they were riding relatively slow. I mean, there were always slow times.
So I guess you have to keep busy during slow times. Oh, my God, that is hilarious. That is too funny. So what are you doing these days? You're only building a couple of frames. That's funny. Offered him $200. You know what? Somebody probably accept that money today, now that I think about it.
Yeah, that is especially
a frame builder, right? So, what are you?
Nobody has made me that offer.
The other thing I learned about you, and I do want to bring this up, is you have triplets.
Yes.
Oh my goodness, what was that like raising three boys? Well, I know you have five children. There are evidently two other singles, but triplets? How the heck? Well, it happens.
It happens, and you do what you have to do, and I am totally blessed because they are great kids, and often people are unhappy with their children, and I am so happy I can go through. I trust my kids. I have confidence that any time they had to make a choice for me, it would be the right choice.
It's because you raised them right.
Well, I did a lot of things that probably weren't the best thing for them at the time, and they turned out to be great, so maybe.
Yeah, maybe. So what are you doing besides being a grandfather? And tell me about the wine. What are you making?
Let's see. Each year I make seven barrels. A barrel holds 300 cases, 300 bottles. 25 cases.
How'd you come up with the number seven? It's a lucky number. It's a good number. But
seven is it's partly a function of how many corks you can buy, how many bottles can you buy, and still get a reasonable price. And so the company I buy bottles from has a $1,000 minimum. A case of bottles is right around $10. And so you just have to factor that in to how many you buy. Corks, the minimum I can buy is a bag of 1,000. And so I buy 2,000 corks, or last year I bought 3,000. And corks don't really last, so you have to get fresh corks every year.
These are real corks as opposed to the plastic thingies.
Yeah, well, okay. I've been buying a composite cork, which is made out of real cork. It has the ends that are just like a regular cork, and then the inside is ground-up cork.
Yeah, okay.
And they work just fine. And one of the things about wine from home winemakers is you don't seal them. In a regular winery, they actually inject nitrogen into the bottle when they cork everything. And so the wine lasts longer. And so I've had wines that taste good after 7 or 8 years, but you can't really count on it. So, and it's just a matter of not having the technical equipment to do that kind of thing.
Hmm.
And varietals, I've made stuff that you probably have never heard of.
Like what?
Fiano, Arneas, Legrand, Teraldigo, those are four Italian varietals.
We actually had a bottle that somehow came from you, but it was through Philwood.
Oh, it was a Cabernet Franc, probably, Peter Enright. Peter Enright, or you might have got it from
Peter. I got it from Peter.
Yeah.
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 We go to Philwood whenever we're out on the West Coast.
Yeah.
Go see him.
So Peter wanted to participate in the wine group, and that didn't exactly work out, but Brent, who was working for Phil at the time, has been in the group ever since.
You know what? Maybe it was Brent we got it from. That's right, because Brent I knew before I even knew Peter.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Wow.
And so those, and then, you know, the typical ones, Zinfandel and
yummy.
Cabernet and Merlot and Pinot Noir and Pinot Gris. This year I'm doing Sauvignon Blanc, Grenache as a rosé, Malbec, Mourvèdre. Let's see.
I'm not hearing anything I don't like so far.
Val de Gruyère again. And what was the other one? There's one more. Cabernet Franc.
So did you have any problems with the earthquake? Was everything okay? Are you...
It shook the bed. We woke up at 3:20 and went back to sleep. But then one of my buddies who works at Bouchane in Carneros, I talked to him and he sent me a bunch of pictures. And those are the pictures I posted on Facebook.
Ah.
And Reuters had a good picture of Andrew in front of a mess at Bouchane on their news service. Let's see, what else? You know, Chardonnay, Roussanne, Gewürztraminer.
Wow, that's a lot of different types.
Yeah, I'll do, let's see, Viognier.
So how much property do you have up there that you're
growing? I don't have any property. I buy grapes. I have grape plants growing in the yard. Mainly, they're volunteers from the seeds that have been dumped in the garden. And they sprout, ultimately.
Yeah.
So where I live is sort of an unusual space. It's right in downtown Oakland. It's a 7,500 square foot lot with a 2,000 square foot living space next to a 2,500 square foot shop. And I share the shop with, I'm getting a smaller and smaller part of it with my sons, two of them who are cabinet makers.
Isn't somebody still making frames? Or is that not so?
Me.
Just
the only ones. Yeah, my other son, Zachary, he's the one that did the most with me. They all worked for me at one time or another. Miles, in particular, painted for me. And I did some subcontract painting for Tom Ritchie, and Miles did that. And also I did some subcontract building for Marin, and Miles painted those. So they're all good with their hands.
So could I order one of your frames if I wanted one?
Sure.
Don't tempt me there, buddy. Huh? I just might do that. Well, geez, I wish we had like 10 hours to sit and talk, but we actually are done for at least for this evening. Will you come back on and talk to me again?
Sure. Yeah, I can talk. It seems like I see.
You can. So. You can talk and you have great memories. And people, I think, are going to be really excited to hear from you. I am.
Okay. Okay.
So thank you very much. I hope you have a wonderful...
It was fun, yeah. And I hope whoever's listening is being careful riding their bike. And look out for the crazy lady out there.
Wait, are you talking about me? Oh,
the crazy lady.
Yeah.
There's another one out there that's just waiting to run you over.
Yes, she is. And boy, we talk about that plenty on the show. Well, Albert, thank you so much for talking with me. We will talk again, I promise.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, now, well, now. Was that exciting or what?
My fingers are a little tired from going back to Wikipedia so many times with all the names he threw out.
Well, you know, as he said, he hasn't been interviewed since 1960-whatever on the radio, or yeah. Somebody did a documentary of him. I'd like to see that. That was probably one of my all-time favorites. He's just wonderful. And you know what? I can order a frame. He would build me a frame.
You can get exactly what you want then, right?
Well, I'm supposed to be able to do that from somebody. We won't go there. All right. So we have a little bit of news. I know that this was just the best interview ever, but we are going to take just a few minutes, and you promised to talk to us about the Vuelta, and we've got some news. So what do you got to say about the Vuelta?
A lot of exciting things going on in a long 21-stage race. We've got 8 stages left. September 14th will be the final stage. And one of the biggest bits of news, Nairo Quintana crashed out of the race.
I know. Twice.
Twice. The second was the last one. He ended up with his first crash that he had was, as he claims, caused by the brakes on the bike. It wasn't caused by anything else. Did you see the video?
I always have to ask about those kinds of things. Really?
Right. Well,
he was going very, very fast, he hit his brakes.
And from the video that I saw, he just got finished adjusting his shoes, got back, and it looked like he was kind of offline going through the corner. And it was probably similar to Taylor Finney's incident. Now, Taylor was avoiding a course vehicle.
True.
Not just in a stage all by himself and just ran into this. But so he had his crash, lost 3 minutes from that. And then on the next stage on Wednesday, 20 kilometers in, there was another crash and he went down again and that was it.
And he had successful shoulder surgery. I saw that come up on my feed this week. So obviously they said he's going to be back on the bike in a couple of weeks. So who is leading the race?
So at this point, we have Alberto Contador.
Yes.
And Valverde is in second, okay, which is really good. And we have Christopher Froome, some guy from Great Britain.
Some dude.
Who's in fourth, who we didn't hear about over the last couple of months. But he's back. One of the interesting things that I found, and at this time, the stage is as of Wednesday, as of Thursday, actually. Now we're starting to get into a lot more of the difficult stages. So we're going to see what happens in the next couple of days. But
okay.
I've got an interesting article on Mr. Talansky.
Oh, you know he's my man.
Yes. And so he came back, actually. This is his first race since the tour, since he was out. And to quote, "I wasn't bluffing when I said my only purpose was to ride a grand tour, to get that training in my body building towards next season. When you're fit and flying on the bike, you enjoy racing. You enjoy the suffering. The Vuelta is a different experience. I look at this as an extended training camp for myself." So it's really good to see that he's back on the bike and he's in the race, but he's out there, as he just said.
Sure.
It's simply training and that's it. So we've got 8 more stages left from here and now it gets interesting.
Well, we'll see how that goes. All right. We have several other news items. We talked to Nancy Gibson in Rwanda. She's the London hairstylist who went over to Rwanda. And when she was finished with her 3-week tour, she was leaving this super high-end carbon bike for the other women in Rwanda. Well, I think women are very much suited to getting things done. It turns out that there is another woman who has decided to do something similar, only she needs to raise some funds to get this bike over there. Her name is Bria Shirk. She's a graduate student at the University of Minnesota, where she studies maternal and child global health. And she's going to be working on a nutrition project this fall with the UN FAO in Kigali, which is the capital of Rwanda, promoting mothers and their children's health during the first 1,000 days of pregnancy and infancy. She says, "I am an active person and in my, quote, unquote, other life. I work as a wilderness instructor and have been a competitive athlete most of my life. So as part of her commitment to the work she's doing, she started this new project to help get another racing bike for the Rwandan women's athletes. There are still 50 days left in her campaign. If you're interested, it's on Indiegogo. You just need to search for racing bike for Rwandan women athletes. Cool, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. What else you got?
Our buddy Taylor Finney.
Oh, yeah.
He's going to be at Interbike on September 10th.
Well, I have to admit, this is the first year in I don't know how many years, probably 15, that I will not be at Interbike. But I wish I could have seen you, Taylor. If I knew you were going to be there, I might have made a different choice. But yeah.
Well, he posted this up on Twitter the other day, and one of the interesting things, he now has a hashtag that he uses. It's called, the hashtag is Frankenleg.
Why, they sew his leg on backwards?
Probably not, but yeah. It does it. It looks pretty gruesome.
So you mean the scar?
Yes.
Yeah.
So if you're anywhere near Interbike and you want to go see Taylor, September 10th, he will be there with the folks at the Big Ring Insurance booth.
Oh, okay. Very cool. Well, this comes from London, and I have like two words. He's out. I thought this was interesting. Sprint specialist Mark Cavendish was left off the squad, announced by Great Britain on Thursday for the UCI Road World Championships in Spain later this month.
Mm-hmm.
Cavendish, the 2011 world champion, had to undergo shoulder surgery after crashing on the opening stages of this year's Tour de France in the northern English town of Harrogate. The eight-man British team that will attack the hilly Ponferrada road race course on September 28th features 2013 Tour de France champion Chris Froome, we just talked about him, and two-time Olympic track cycling gold medalist Geraint Thomas. Olympic silver medalist Lizzie Armistead will spearhead a six-strong team in the women's race a day earlier. So in the time trial, which takes place on the 24th of September, 2011 and 2013 world's runner-up and 2012 Olympic gold medalist Bradley Wiggins, along with Commonwealth Games gold medalist Alex Dowsett, are in contention for the two men's places. So Mark Cavendish has been dissed, as we say.
Yep.
Yep. What else you got?
So during the seventh stage of the Vuelta, Ryder Hegedal had a crash.
And oh.
Did you see the crash?
No.
No? Okay. Well, he had a crash.
I'm trying to stay away from all these crashes.
No. It was the crash wasn't that difficult for him.
Oh.
The bike went down, and if you watch a video of the crash, the bike sits there, and the rear wheel is continuing to spin, and it spins the whole entire bike around, which caused people to question, is the bike on juice? Is the bike doping? Is it motorized? Is there something in there?
Oh, I did see that.
Yes. And if you look at the Cervelo.
It's a short video.
Yes. It's like a 12-second video.
Right, but
the way that the bike is designed with the carbon and the big space. So the funny thing is the UCI actually went and examined Garmin Sharp team bikes in response to this.
No.
Because there were so many people saying, wait a minute. He fell. It should have stopped. It shouldn't have spun. It actually got to be it actually got kind of funny. But if you watch the video, it's really neat. They did not. The UCI found nothing illegal with the bike. Everything is fine. It's just one of those.
Yeah.
I think it's a body in motion thing.
Body in motion. A body in motion. Never mind.
Okay.
Yeah. So in a kind of turnabout is not fair play case,
mm-hmm.
A cyclist will be tried for beating up a motorist in a road rage incident. Did you see this?
Yes.
Yeah, it's kind of sad. This is in Marin County. A Marin County judge ruled there's enough evidence to proceed with a criminal trial against a technology executive accused of getting off his bike and beating a motorist in Mill Valley. Ay, 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 ay. Kenfield resident Jeffrey Smock, 40, allegedly attacked the driver of a pickup truck who veered toward Smock as the two were traveling on East Blithedale Avenue in April, according to the police and prosecution. I'm telling you, I just don't, you know, either we win them or we really lose them. So we're losing this one. Citing witnesses, they said that the two men caught up with each other at the intersection of Camino Alto and that Smock severely beat the motorist, even as bystanders yelled and honked their horns. Smock is charged with felony assault by means likely to cause great bodily harm, and he faces up to 7 years in state prison if convicted. Judge Kelly Simon sent the case toward trial Wednesday after a preliminary hearing in San Rafael in which Mill Valley police officers testified. Neither Smock nor his alleged victim took the witness stand. What the heck?
Again, we've talked about video cameras, about GoPros or any of those. And without these, it's he said, she said. And
true.
It's bound to happen. You can't just... I understand how frustrated we get. But we're bound to see this more often, probably.
Okay. So, you got one more?
Yeah. So, Jens Voigt retired.
Yeah, except he didn't. Yeah,
except he didn't.
He's going to try a world, what, hour record?
Yeah. Thursday evening,
you
September.
You mean he retired again?
Well, he retired from active racing of some sort, whatever. So on Thursday evening, September 18th, he will attempt the hour record of cycling at the Velodrome Suisse in Gröncheln, Switzerland. And this is going to be the last big step of his career. At least that's what they're claiming for this time.
Well, and then somebody, it was really funny because I think I actually posted the blurb about that on my Facebook page. And one of the comments was, shut up, clock.
Yeah.
Instead of shut up, legs.
Yeah, well, that was it. You can come up with so many different things. But, you know, this would be really a good way for him to go out. And the last record, the current record, which is... It was set in 2005, so it's been around for a long time.
Do you know who by?
Andrei Sosenka.
Oh, okay. And what is the record? Do you have a time or a distance?
It's 60 minutes.
Don't be a smart aleck.
Can't.
I know you can't help.
Can't help it. Actually, it's 49.7 kilometers.
All right. Well, we'll see how he does.
He'll keep going. He will stop the clock and continue and do what that is. So.
Well, that is our news for tonight. That is our show for tonight. I hope you enjoyed our interview with Albert Eisentraut. It just doesn't get much better than that. I hope you also go for a ride. Don't forget, Ride for Miles tomorrow happens right here on the John Carroll campus. If you are interested in riding, rideformiles.org. If not, you can get out there and just go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.